At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Nuance Needed podcast. I'm Amanda.
And I'm Sam.
And we have a very special guest, Matthew Facciani, who is a misinformation researcher, is here. How are you today, Matthew?
I'm doing all right. How are you doing?
You know,
the horrors persist, but so do we. That's Sam's motto.
2025, okay, I guess, is kind of how it is. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mid at best.
Yes. Same. Yes, definitely. Well, Matthew, we're so excited to have you on because we just feel like this is you do what Sam and I are passionate about, but you actually research it and have real things to talk about and back people up. Where sometimes I think Sam and I just point out, you know, mental health misinformation where, yeah, can you tell us a little bit about your background and what you do and how you got into this work?
Yeah, so my background is a bit of a journey because I actually started out, originally in undergrad times, I thought I wanted to be a clinical psychologist and go into studying psychotherapy and all of that. And yeah, I got interested in the brain as I was studying psychology as an undergraduate. So I actually worked in a hospital doing like neuropsych evaluations for brain injury patients. So I thought I was going to do like clinical neuropsychology. And then I started doing some brain imaging, and then I thought I wanted to do cognitive neuroscience. So I actually applied to a PhD program in cognitive neuroscience, and then I realized I didn't want to study cognitive neuroscience after a few years. But I was really interested in like this whole neural decoding process of putting someone in an fMRI and having them think about really anything. But the research at the time I was really interested in is like, have people think about a list of words, and based off their brain activity, you could actually predict what kind of word they were thinking of. And some of the work that I did was in regards to emotion. So we had people think about different emotional concepts, so we can kind of, based off their brain activity, try to detect what kind of emotion they were experiencing while they were in the scanner. But I was always interested in bigger issues and how people form beliefs and how they navigate their worlds. And even from learning about a lot of social psychology with like the Solomon Asch studies and the conformity studies of just having someone in front of you give a wrong answer, and then you're more likely to give a wrong answer, even if it's a very simple task, like that kind of stuff, that social influence stuff was always fascinating to me. I've always been interested in belief systems and religion, politics, any kind of ideology that guides how people understand their worlds. That's always been interesting. And I was thinking about studying that as a neuroscientist, but I wasn't really in the right program to do that. So the short story is I was talking to some sociology professors at the same university and telling them how I was interested in belief systems and how people come to make decisions about their worlds based on identities and ideologies and all that stuff. And basically I was able to switch PhD programs and then study social psychology and sociology with a focus on different attitudes, religious attitudes, political attitudes. And then I was studying political polarization specifically for my dissertation. And during that time, that was I graduated in 2020. So that was a really great time to look for an academic job. but thankfully, I was able to find one. And it was at Vanderbilt University, a research position that looked at health and the social elements of health, a lot of different perspectives going into how people make decisions about health and then think about different health attitudes, LGBT health also. So I ended up studying a lot of COVID-19 information processing more broadly, like how people processed information about COVID-19, about vaccines. And it really got me more interested in public health more generally, just, you know, navigating what I was studying, political attitudes, political polarization during this time of the, you know, right in the middle of the pandemic. And that got me interested in then thinking about, well, maybe I could turn some of this into a book and study this more directly. So I wrote this op-ed about like why people were against wearing masks and talking about political attitudes and how that intersected with mask wearing, even though it's a pretty simple thing, a pretty evidence-based process where, you know, surgeons wear masks all the time. This is something that we've been doing for a very long time. And it's just kind of makes sense from a hygiene perspective. Like if you have a cold, you know, you get less stuff in the air if you have a little barrier in between. But because of how it was politicized, it became this big issue and this big political identity thing where either wearing a mask or not wearing a mask was representative of your politics. So when I wrote that little op-ed, some people found it interesting. And
I feel like I read that article.
Like, oh, you did?
I feel like I definitely read an article about that.
Yeah, maybe you did. So yeah, it's just, I know I'm just kind of going on my whole life journey here. I never thought I would end up writing a book, especially that early on in my career, but I sent some cold emails to various publishers and gave them this idea of studying misinformation more broadly. And thankfully, a few people were interested and I ended up with a contract. And now it's finally coming out this summer in July.
Amazing.
Wow. And then, yeah, so most recently I've been working at the University of Notre Dame studying information processing and media literacy, digital literacy, and developing tools to teach people critical thinking skills and how to navigate information environments and artificial intelligence. And broadly, I study how social and psychological factors influence our beliefs and how we encounter our worlds. So that falls under the umbrella of misinformation, but I know that's a very polarized term as well. So that's kind of my whole journey in a few minutes.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, should we start with how do you define the word misinformation, or how do scientists, researchers define it?
Yeah. So misinformation is an academic term that's been in psychology literature for decades now. It broadly means false or misleading information. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, can apply to lots of different things. And originally, like in the 80s, it was often referenced in memory research. So like dealing with like false memories and people who have this bias in their memories about something that didn't actually happen. So it was like studies where you would ask someone to remember something, but then you might give them some confusing information and they'd have misinformation about what exactly happened in the event. So that's kind of how it started, just this broad term of understanding the psychology of how we process information and when the information was not consistent with the best available evidence that we had, or if it didn't actually even happen. So what's been interesting to see is how that's evolved over the years and has become much more popular, really since, you know, 2015, 2016, with the presidential election of Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. That's really when a lot of people became much more interested in it. But I was studying misinformation and political bias really around 2015, 2014 is kind of when I dove into those topics more scholarly. So it's unfortunate that sometimes that idea of misinformation can be conflated with telling people what to think, because that's never the approach that I have with it. It's always about trying to understand how our own psychological biases guide us to process information and how sometimes that doesn't always connect with the best available evidence. And it's something we're all vulnerable of. So I try to talk about how to increase our critical thinking skills and be more aware of our own biases so we can all be better equipped to navigate this complex information world.
The one thing I was thinking, Matthew, is because I'm glad you brought that up, because I do think there is this critique of like, if we call something misinformation, someone gets to be the arbitrator of what is true and what is false. And that is like a lot of the pushback I see in probably what you do. So my guess is you've probably encountered that too. What is your typical response to people who say that?
Yeah, I mean, so again, how I approach it as a social scientist is more about the understanding how we all have these vulnerabilities to be influenced by the identities and communities we belong to and how this can impact how we process information. So a lot of my research deals with teaching people about those biases that we all have. And it's always about teaching people how to think instead of what to think. So my focus really isn't, you know, playing whack-a-mole, trying to debunk everything. There are some people that do that with like fact-checking and stuff.
Yeah.
That's not even really my area. Right. Whenever I do say something is misinformation, I try to be very careful about it. And I think that's something that journalists and scientists or anyone with a public facing audience or any kind of public writing should be very careful about, because when things are evolving, we don't always know if something is going to be true or false. And sometimes misinformation can be really tricky to hammer out and be very confident about. So, you know, there's a couple things that are pretty clear cut. So like during the pandemic, the claim that drinking bleach would cure COVID. So like, that's a pretty clear example. We can, you know, very clearly say, okay, there's a bunch of evidence that just shows that this is not true. And it's also harmful if people were going around drinking bleach. So I think it's okay to label that as misinformation. But then there's other things that, you know, are evolving that are a little bit more complicated. So like, again, with the pandemic, early on, we didn't really know much about how it started. So there is this whole debate about the origins and if it was a lab leak versus from an animal in a wet market. So I don't think it would be fair to label like that discussion either direction as misinformation. Mm-hmm. And I'm not an expert in the biological mechanisms of viruses, but I've read about it and the papers about it. And it seems like, from what I can tell, the scientific consensus leans towards a zoonotic origin, like from an animal. But we don't have good data on that. So it's still like more complex and more, there's a lot more nuance to that question, even if we can lean one way or the other. So like for that, I wouldn't necessarily, you know, be really confident saying, oh, if someone thinks that it came from a lab leak, I'm not going to hammer them on misinformation in that example. But generally, for me, I don't even try to go that route of trying to hammer what's true or false. In my own research, when I do have misinformation in the studies that I do, it's very clear false headlines, for example, like stuff that I just made up or someone else has made up that is not even, you know, connected to any sort of evolving scientific question. It's really trying to tap into people's political biases. Like, are you more likely to believe this false story because of your political identity? And trying to think of that in terms of misinformation. And that false headline that I used, it doesn't have any factual base behind it. So it's hopefully very clear cut. And it's not about trying to say one political opinion is true or false. It's more about understanding how political identities can misguide us and how we process the world.
Makes sense.
I'm trying to decide which question I want to start with, because I, having been someone who has been very interested in like politics my whole life, I was a weird kid. I blame my dad for that. But, you know, and kind of like as an observer, as a consumer of, you know, political content, if you will, I've seen it, like if I look back the last 20 years of paying attention, which would put me in like my early teens to now, I can see like the resistance to calling out something as false if we agree with it. Like almost like if mm-hmm. there's a part of us that's like wanting it to be true, if that yeah. makes sense, because like it validates our belief system. It's the confirmation bias. It's the entrenchment of our like belief systems on either side and becoming more rigid in that. And so I think for you, like studying this and paying attention to it, is part of your misinformation study also tied to like conspiracy theories? Are those like one and the same. Would you classify conspiracy theories as misinformation, or is misinformation a result of conspiracy theories, or are they essentially like under the same umbrella?
Yeah, I mean, again, misinformation, it's so broad, like right. Literally false or misleading information. That can be like everything, you know, if yeah. you really think about it, there's a lot of information that is, you know, incomplete. Again, I try to be really careful about labeling stuff as misinformation. Mm. And if it's, you know, definitively against the best available evidence, then that's where I try to group that as misinformation. Conspiracy theories are tricky, though, because I think there's a type of psychological profile of conspiracies that is different than more general misinformation. It's trying to find patterns in something and trying to make sense of something. And in some ways, there's, you know, positives and skepticism. It's just when that becomes too far. You know, it's really tricky to measure some of these conspiracy theory ideas and conspiracism, but there is a general pattern of thinking about finding a simple answer for a complex event happening in the world. I feel like that's often a hallmark, is there's just some person or group of people behind this bad thing. That's a common one, right? And it's like, sometimes there's just, you know, bad things happen and there's incompetence and there's chaos and randomness. And a lot of times the truth is a lot messier and not as certain and clean and simple as a lot of these conspiracy theories that try to find pattern and meaning among the chaos. So I think when I think about conspiracy theories, and again, misinformation more broadly, I try to think about why people have this motivation to see the world in that way that might be more extreme or separate from the best available evidence that I would consider the best available evidence. And this kind of dives into public health, but also science more generally. When people have a distrust in science or scientific institutions, I think it's important to understand where that's coming from. Instead of just focusing on, you know, the claim itself or the belief itself. For example, with COVID-19 and the vaccine, there was a lot of mistrust in the vaccine. And you can dive into that specific example, and lots of people attack misinformation from this debunking frame of like, yes. Okay, we're going to debunk all these claims. And it's kind of like whack-a-mole. You're constantly trying to do that. And some people very aggressively focus on debunking claims. That's one approach. The approach, again, that I take is try to understand how people are arriving at their conclusion and where those beliefs come from and where those motivations come from. So if you don't trust scientific institutions, why is that? Where does that belief stem from? And then having a conversation about how you came to this conclusion and why you might trust one institution versus another. And you can really dive into why someone thinks the way they do.
Have you spent time focusing on this idea? Because the term that I think is most commonly used right now is we're in this like post-truth world. And I think there would be this argument from either side that that's happening on both sides, quote unquote, right? And so I think, because I felt like there was a time in my life where you would hear like a news story would break and there would be all of these different stories and all of this different conflicting information. And then eventually over time, as more information presented itself, you could kind of like narrow yourself to, oh, okay, that's what happened. And having people be like, no, it wasn't that, it was this. And there was kind of like a mutual consensus of what the end result is. Maybe we disagreed on how it happened or how we got there, but there was this consensus of like where we all were. Now, I feel that there are people that you could give them like factual information that's been confirmed, however you want to say that that was done, right? But we know for a fact that A, B, C, D is true, right? And you show that to people and they go, no. Mm-hmm. Kind of this resistance to that. I'm really curious if you spent time researching that, what came up for you? And maybe like, what is the understanding there of the resistance to people being introduced to something that challenged what they thought, and the unwillingness to accept that maybe what they originally thought wasn't correct, and this clinging to what was incorrect as truth?
Yeah, so I think humans have always had a psychological bias to protect their identities and align with certain social groups. What has happened recently that's different is with the age of social media and our separate realities that have come from that. And a lot of people have written about this and taken different perspectives. I really enjoyed the book Invisible Rulers by Renee DiResta. If you guys haven't read that one, she does a good job really breaking down how we have these bespoke realities that you can find yourself into, like these little mini echo chambers that constantly reinforce what you want to believe. And it connects to my work and a lot of other people's works that look at how people will find themselves in these alternative realities. And they're just separated from other people. And I think that's what gets so tricky and that's what makes them an alternative reality is that they're so insular and they have this whole storyline and all these characters that all reinforce each other. And importantly, it's very communal. So like you have this group of people that you connect with and you have these shared stories and these shared myths. It kind of goes back to like, you know, early humans. We have this desire to connect with our social group through shared myths. Like that's something that's just been fundamental to the human species since we've been around. And now it's accelerated to the point so much that it's so fractured and so personalized, it can be so amplified that you can have a very tailored algorithm that is very different than your neighbor. So you can have two people that live right next to each other, but they're getting very different information from their internet. And it completely shapes how they view the world. And it's not just the information. I think the important part and the part that I focus on is that social component too. So if you get whatever information you have, and maybe it's not the most reliable or the most evidence-based, doesn't align with the consensus, but all of the people you know agree with that set of understanding of the world, then you have a motivation to connect with those folks because they give you a lot of social interaction, social meaning, community, and address a lot of these social needs that are fundamental to being a human being. So, you know, there's, you know, one of the examples I mentioned on my book, and I cite this documentary came out, I think in 2018, Behind the Curve. I don't know if either of you have saw that, the documentary on Netflix. It talks about flat earthers.
See that.
I really think they did a really good job because they talk about they frame it as in like the importance of community, and they really talk about that. And imagine you meet some flat earthers that are all your friends and you hang out, and like that's your group of people, and just try to think about the pros and cons of then updating your belief about the Earth's shape. The Earth's shape doesn't really impact your day-to-day life, if whatever you believe it is, right? Yeah. So like if you think it's a square or a sphere, it doesn't really change how you feel every day. But if all your friends from your flat Earth group are, you're hanging out with them, you're having a good time, and then you're like, uh-oh, I think the Earth actually might be round, and then that means all my friends are not going to want to hang out with me anymore. That's a very direct consequence to updating your belief. So there's a strong psychological motivation to not go that direction and not even seek out information that may challenge you. And I think that speaks to a lot of the information processing we see more broadly. So the flat Earth example is pretty extreme because there's so much data and so much evidence that shows that it's round. But you can use that as like a case study to think about how community and social identity biases us to process information in a way that will keep us aligned with our social group and have those social needs met that everyone has.
That's so fascinating. That makes so much sense. I think too, it's like I can feel myself even right when I'm exposed to ideas that I don't agree with or push me, right? Like you can, I think you can feel it in your body, like physically, like, you know, physiologically, you're like, there is a resistance to this. There's a resistance to change. And I think that we've just gotten, you know, through algorithms, through these like echo chambers you've been talking about, it makes us like, would you say it's true to say that we've lost we've become more polarized, but do you also think we've like lost tolerance to interact with different ideas or – Yeah,
I think so. I mean, I think we just are not practicing it anymore. It's just like anything else. Like if you're not practicing a sport or something, like you're going to get rusty. And we don't interact with people who think differently than us. And again, this is something that's been discussed through various people and their platforms. But just the idea that if we're not spending time working with each other and working with our neighbors and our communities, then, you know, we might not interact with people who think differently than us and might not have the same tolerance and experience of trying to interact with someone who has a different view on the world than us. So it might be really comfortable to just always be around people who think just like you. Whereas if you join like a bowling league in your local community that has like a lot of different people in it, a lot of different backgrounds, maybe you have to talk to someone who thinks very differently about politics than you, but you're still in the same bowling league. So you're still maintaining some civil connection with them. Mm-hmm. But if you're not joining any bowling leagues and you're only hanging out with people that align with your politics and only joining like political groups that exactly align with your own, then you're much more vulnerable to bias and misinformation. And this is something that I talk about in my book. And it's, again, an idea that has been studied in social science for decades. I've just been reframing it in terms of misinformation. And this is this idea of what's called social identity complexity. And basically all that means is if you have more complexity, you have more identities that are more independent of each other. Hmm. So you can think of it like on a map. And some people have actually used this as an exercise. You draw all of your identities, your important identities, on like a map. And the ones that are closer to each other, you put them closer together spatially on the map. So let's say you have an extreme example. You have your political identity, your religious identity, let's say your friend identity, and they all completely overlap because where you think about politics and where you go to church and all of your friends are all in the same space and it all shares the same set of meanings. That's in a very complete overlapping circle. Now imagine you get some information that conflicts with those set of meanings. That literally means your entire sense of self is being attacked because it's all under that very narrow lens of identities and meanings and values. So it really feels like a very personal attack, and it's really hard to process information that challenges any of those values of that small set of meanings. Conversely, if you have a higher social identity complexity, meaning more independence, let's say you have a religious identity and a political identity, but they're at completely opposite ends of the map. So they don't share a lot of overlap. Maybe they have some overlap, that's okay. But it's not completely viewing the world in the same lens. And let's say you have friends that don't go to your church and don't share your politics, then you have this very wide net of identity meanings. So anytime you experience information that challenges one of your identities, it's not a complete assault on your sense of self. It's only a little bit. And this connects with other research looking at whenever people are basically feeling more self-affirmed and more self-assured, they're better able to process challenging information to their identities. And I think it all falls under this general concept of having more space allocated to being able to process identity threats and challenging information. When we have more resources and a broader lens of self-esteem to rely on, then we're better able to process information more objectively.
Wow, 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 wow.
This is, honestly, this is like very validating to my own
fragile identity.
My own fragile identity system. Going back to what you said earlier about this idea of community. And that because of social media and because of work from home or, you know, cars in the United States and loss of third spaces and all of these sorts of things, we've become more separated, more siloed, less like separation of these different identities. And so much of it is tied to we've lost like multifaceted community. Mm-hmm. And so we're not meeting new people, new ideas, new things. And so that muscle that gets flexed when we do interact with somebody who is different than us or has a different culture or different belief system or different life experience, we're seeing that less and less. So that muscle has just like completely atrophied. Mm-hmm. And the only thing that feels comfortable is letting that atrophied muscle rest in our echo chambers that just like validate, validate, validate. Like, no, you're right. You're right. You're right. You're right.
And I think even more too, Sam, as you're saying that, I'm thinking also of like, there's also so much like purity like pressure, right? Of like in terms of, I think there is such a movement of you are looked at as a better person, as a more moral or value-centric person if all of your friends and family and all of your community all does agree, because that means you're better than other people in some way.
You've like weeded out the bad ones.
Yes, you're not but what I love, Matthew, about your work is we're actually saying that you're more susceptible to misinformation.
Live that way.
Yeah, and that's so – because I think that is so counter, because most people are like, my echo chamber is the right echo chamber, or I'm not in an echo chamber. I am in the truth and everyone else is wrong. And, you know, again, that moral purity of that's why it's so great that all of my family and friends and my work agrees, which we could go into a whole nother thing about like – you know, Gen Z and I think like millennials and how we are we putting to like are we demanding like perfectionism in every place we are at? But yeah, what do you think of any of those things we just said, Matthew?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's definitely something that I've been thinking about a lot the last 2 years. And I've studied this, you know, academically as far as like looking at people's network structures and seeing, you know, if they just have one person different politically than them, they're far less likely to believe political misinformation, for example.
Like that's
wow.
That just, is one,
just
one
person. Yes. Just one person. Yeah, it makes a huge difference. And again, this is stuff that's been replicated over the years in psychology with like contact hypothesis stuff. Just exposure to people who think differently than you presents this opportunity for you to reflect on your own biases too. So it's not even so much the idea of them sharing their own perspective, which is important. It's like, okay, this person's going to ask me a question that I might not have thought of. And for me, it's fascinating. I consume a lot of different media, like right-wing media, left-wing media, center, people identify as centrist. Like, and I really try to, what's fascinating is when I consume these different types of media, I'll see them present their arguments. And I'm thinking about it, and I'm like, this argument appears as though they have never had a conversation with someone from the other side of the aisle, because like they would immediately know, even if they can still hold their opinion, but like the argument that they're making could have been easily debunked and countered by just someone who thinks a little bit differently, that it seems like they never even had that conversation. So whenever we have these opportunities to talk to people who think differently than us, it's not even so much that we're learning about their perspective. It's that we're reflecting on our own biases and our own gaps in our perspectives that we might have. And so I think there's a lot of utility if we want to increase our buffer against misinformation and bias. One of the best ways is to speak with people who think differently than us.
And be open to what they say. Right? But like not necessarily like open in a way of like you're easily swayed, because I also think a lot of the people that I work with or people that I know personally, I think sometimes there is this fear that they almost don't trust themselves to withstand in their own value system while they are introduced to the values of others. Like kind of this idea that if they do that, they run the risk of just being like this leaf in the wind that just gets blown everywhere. I also find that a lot in people who come to me for deconstruction work from religion, but kind of like this idea of like reinventing their identity and not sure who they are because they were forced to be like so rigid in that structure. Are, you know, going back to what you brought up with this idea of like you follow a lot of, you know, all the way from right-wing media to the left-wing media to the middle, I'm assuming you are seeing that we are both making this mistake on both ends of kind of this like throwing out these stories and these interpretations of stories with little to no exposure from what another person might believe or how another person sees it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it's like you don't even understand your opponent. Like you don't even understand where they're coming from. And I think that's the most frustrating thing as an observer is like, it's like, okay, you're making this point. And again, I know there's some people who are paid to present a point. So they're perhaps
and
not
fuel
the most...
the fire. Like,
yeah. Joke. So I'm not necessarily talking about people who have that financial motivation to only say red team, blue team, because that's a whole other conversation. I'm talking about people who maybe are trying to be more objective, or just, you know, normal people who are not a political pundit, but are, you know, presenting their opinions publicly. And I think, yeah, just being able to reflect on the other person's perspective, it doesn't mean you have to change your own value system. It just try to learn from what they're saying can go a long way. And I talk about how to have productive dialogue with people. And when I talk about these strategies, I never say it's in order to change someone's mind. I don't think that should ever be the goal. The goal should be, how do I reduce these psychological barriers that increase the odds of my perspective at least being heard? And that, I think, is something that we can do. And there's a lot of social science that can guide us towards that. But ultimately, it's the person's decision on whether or not they update their belief or not. But but a lot of times, they don't even listen to what we're trying to say because of all these psychological biases.
Well, and to go back to just really quick what I brought up about this idea of being afraid that they're going to be like this leaf in the wind and have like no values if they listen to other people's values. I think I know, even in myself, I've done this personally when I have spoken to somebody different from me. I feel this insane level of defensiveness because I feel like in my like worst parts of myself that it is my job to change their mind, to like introduce them to why I'm right. And I think that's something that I've been really trying to like check in myself, because it's one, it's a losing game, but then two, I'm only causing myself more harm because I'm just like raising my cortisol level by taking on all of this pressure of saying like, I have to change this person.
Yeah. I mean, I remember, Sam, like in my past before, I've literally felt like I am responsible for everyone in my life voting the way that I think they should vote. And like, I would like subliminally like grade myself, I think, on like, how did I do my duty to like make sure they voted at all, or make sure that, you know, did I convince them enough? And I just love, Matthew, that what you're saying is really, instead of this like getting people to our side or forcing something, it is about each, like, how can we be more informed, challenge ourselves individually. And I like also even this idea, because I think – so we're a very openly left podcast and, like, talk about social issues. It's really hard as a therapist.
To be in this industry and not –
because we're watching all of these effects. So I want – like, I've had the thought of – and I've experienced it, right? I think sometimes of, why should I bother, you know – combating this, you know, when I know most, when I'm not going to change my mind, or why would I bother interacting with someone? And I love what you're kind of saying of like, number one, it'll make you more resistant to misinformation. Number two, it sounds like you will, like, instead of being a leaf in the wind, you will like be a tree that grows roots, that's more sure of yourself, that feels more confident then in your ability to go into different situations. And then three, it also sounds like, if we're talking about like politics, like, if we want our values to be spread, people need to be not just interacting with other people because, you know, we need bipartisanship to get deals done, but also literally because if we don't, like, we're not going to be as good at like reaching people where they are and like making a difference and being like a good politician, for, you know, whatever you want to call that.
Well, and a quick personal example as well is my dad. I could not be more left of my father. I have brought him a little bit of the way through a lot of our conversations. Yet he still has like some pretty entrenched like economic like conservative beliefs, right? And something that has actually like calmed me down is sometimes when I'm in my echo chamber that is very catastrophic and the world is constantly ending and every story is the end, I've actually like, and I haven't admitted this to anyone, so this is breaking news to our audience, but I've found that like when I go talk to my dad and he yells at me to calm down, and like tells me why he thinks this is not a big deal. And so he's not happy with where we're at. I just want to give him that much credit. He's not okay. However, he's like calmed me down quite a bit in certain situations where like him and I will be talking on the phone and I'll be like, but and then he's like, well, no, like this is how I see it. And this is what I've been reading and this is what I've been seeing. And even if I don't necessarily like fully agree with like the interpretation or what's being said, I've been able to be like, oh, maybe it's not the end of the world. Like it's not good, but it's not catastrophe.
Like maybe there's another way to look at this. Like there's more than one truth.
Yes. Like maybe hope is still alive.
Yeah.
Like, and so I think that goes to everything that you're saying of this idea of like we need it, it really like what we're talking about is like an ego check. Like that I don't have to be the only arbiter of truth in the world. And someone else also having a viewpoint that also gets to be true too through their lens. And it's more often than not, probably somewhere in the middle.
Hi, everyone. If you're listening and realizing I could really use some support with this, I would love for you to check out our website, therapyforwomencenter.com. We serve 42 states online, and we have 3 in-person office locations in the Philadelphia area. We're coming soon to Collingswood, New Jersey, and we will also be coming soon to Florida. So check us out, and thanks for listening.
Yeah, I mean, especially when we're talking about like huge, broad topics, a lot of times it is really messy and complicated. So again, that kind of gets to the issue of like misinformation being so focused on a binary of true or false. And like, sure, there's like instances like we mentioned earlier with like drinking bleach is, you know, not good for you. But some other things, you know, like economic policy or, I mean, I guess that's also a tough one now as we're seeing some of the effects, but you can see like viewpoints towards different issues that might not be as catastrophic as presented in your particular echo chamber. And I know I've seen some of that too, especially whatever side you're on, you know, we know that emotion spreads faster on social media, like sensationalism, anger, getting people riled up. Like, it makes sense. I'm sure we all experience that. So if your algorithm's constantly saying the left is evil, the right is evil, and then just like always giving the most extreme and the least charitable interpretations of every event, then it's going to totally just warp how you see other people and the world. And it's not an accurate representation of reality. Like the world can have a ton of problems. It does have a lot of problems.
Yeah.
But if we're viewing it through this lens of our echo chamber, that's only sharing the worst elements of people. One, I think it's bad for mental health. I think that's probably not good. And then, also, from like an information perspective, it's going to present a bias that is going to change how we see the world in a way that's not as evidence-based.
Matthew, what do you do for yourself? Is there anything you like notice in yourself? Or because I know you did that also really interesting study about how you can kind of like, you can obviously explain this much better than me, but if you expose people to like, you call it pre-bunking is much more effective than debunking. Maybe we should start with what that is. And then do you use any of that in your life?
Yeah. So there's this whole literature of, it's called pre-bunking. So it's kind of a play on the word debunking, which is after the fact. So the idea is to expose people to types of common manipulation techniques or misleading techniques that people use online, and then expose them to those techniques and those examples ahead of time. So then when they see the actual propaganda, misinformation, whatever you want to call it, they're prepared to be like, oh, I recognize that person. You know, they're trying to get me riled up and get me all excited. And I can see that appeal to emotion, for example.
Are there any others besides appeal to emotion that we should know of? Because that's the main, I mean, that's the main one that comes to mind for me.
That gets me hooked.
Outrage, clickbait.
Every time.
I mean, I feel like that's like the biggest one, honestly. Yeah. So like there are other ones, trying to understand confirmation bias, polarization, the framing that people use. Like one of the studies that worked on last year, a couple of years ago. It was finally published last year, but this idea of like forbidden knowledge, that was more attractive to people. Mm. So the idea, if you frame something as forbidden knowledge or that's being censored or hidden from you, people are more attracted to try to understand what it is, even if the actual information is no more or less true or interesting. Yeah. So the framing, I think, is really important. So a lot of it does come down to framing. And a lot of these pre-bunking and media literacy tools talk about what to look for in framing of headlines and if you're being manipulated or misled. And I think the emotion one is such a great example because we can feel it. Like, so an easy way to try to, or maybe not an easy way, but a simple way to try to understand if you're being manipulated or misinformed is reflect on how it makes you feel when you read something online. So if you read something that makes you really, really angry, that's a signal to reflect on, okay, I'm being really angry. I know that people are financially incentivized to make me angry. Maybe I should look into this further and make sure it's true. And it's something we can constantly do. And I mean, I see this all the time with one thing that really aggravates me is seeing false quotes that are spread virally online. Even if I don't like the politician who is being falsely quoted, it's just wild to see like someone give the false quote of someone and then a bunch of people share it. Be like, oh, this person's so terrible. I can't believe they said this. And then someone will point out like, that's not true. And then the response is like, well, they could have said it anyway because they're so bad. And I'm like, well, no, if we go down that direction, then we're all just being completely devoid of caring about true and false. And then that's not a good position to be in.
Yeah, that's really helpful because to be totally honest, I very much lately in the past few years, I think sometimes, and I wonder if anyone relates to this, is when I see anger or when I feel really angry a lot of times, I literally am like, This is true. This means that, you know, not in everything, but I think in politics.
Well, sometimes it is true too. Sometimes
it's tricky. Right, right. Yeah. And that's what's hard about it is, when things are real, things are making you angry, like policies, like real things are happening. It is hard sometimes to distinguish between, like what is actually making you angry and who is trying to make you angry.
Matthew, I want your interpretation of my strategy that I've started using as of late, and I want you to tell me if I'm wrong. What I realized was on social media, more often than not, I thought I was being informed when really I was just getting someone's interpretation of the information, right? Mm-hmm. So like their emotional response to the headline, their response to what they think will happen, and kind of so much catastrophizing and trying to predict the future. And so what I've tried to do is like really pull back from paying as much attention to that interpretation of stuff and lean more into getting like as factual as you can, right? Like this happened today. This, according to the Constitution, according to laws, according to a judge, right, means this. And then trying to my best to like leave it at that.
Mm-hmm. That speaks to the importance of viewing a diversity of media and trying to see how different people cover the same story. So you mentioned your dad, you know, kind of sometimes will give you a different perspective that calms you down sometimes. And I think that could be that's buffering some of the sensationalism that you might have seen from one source or another. So maybe the truth is maybe still more on how you see it and it more aligns with your values, but maybe you're getting some additional data and information that makes it so it's not as threatening and as terrible as it might have previously felt. Like we're not already crossing a line that you thought we crossed, for example. It's tricky because sometimes we do cross those lines. So that's why I'm cautious to say like, oh, like it's always going to be okay. Like, you know, just read a bunch of media. Sometimes there are bad things happening that don't align with your values and it's okay to be mad about them. That's okay.
Right. But I think what you're saying too is to be aware of if someone is doing something or framing something in a way that adds like kerosene to your emotional fire. Like,
right. That's my point. Yeah.
Yeah. Like reading something factually is going to evoke an emotion in you, whether you agree with it or you disagree with it. But then for us to be really cautious of the emotional response that we're having to the rest of the media that we're consuming around it.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's true. And that's my frustration with a lot of conventional media, yeah. legacy media, really all media, because again, it's incentivized by clicks and et cetera. Mm-hmm. So there's this inherent motivation to make you outraged. So you keep mm-hmm. watching, you keep clicking. And that's what we have to be really mindful of, to not get sucked in that constant outrage chamber of, you know, this person knows that we care about this topic. And maybe there is legitimate bad things happening with that topic, mm-hmm. but also maybe they're exploiting that so we keep clicking on their papers more often mm-hmm. than we need to.
Do you have resources that you like to pull from more than others?
As far as media, when I go for news, I read Reuters, the Associated Press, mm-hmm. the Wall Street Journal, like the most boring factual yeah. sources that I can find. Like, okay. again, I read all kinds of media. So I go in the right wing
for sure.
ecosystem, left wing ecosystem. But whenever I want to look up something, if it's accurate, I try to look at the ones that I think are most credible. And even those ones are not perfect. Like, I don't want to say that any right. one source is perfect. There is research, though, on analyzing the overall credibility. So there's a couple tools that have looked into credibility and bias mm-hmm. of different news sources. What is it, like AdFonts Media is one. Ground News will tell you, like, if one, mm-hmm. If it's being covered more on the left or more on the right. Mm-hmm. So you can kind of get an idea of people's slants, which I think mm-hmm. is important. Mm-hmm. But again, it's just the importance of looking at a diversity of sources and trying to see what the truth is. But there are ones that are better overall, and you can tie that to their economic incentives. So you should look at, when you're evaluating a source, it's like, where are they getting their funding from? Mm. What's their editorial practice? That's why I like the Associated Press, because a lot of their format is not for profit.
Yeah.
So that ends up, they're trying to be more objective because they're not, you know, they're not being paid to present a particular side.
Right.
Yeah. What I also really like about your work, Matthew, is you talk about how it's like, it's not just, we can't just do this alone. We like need right. community. We need mm-hmm. other people. Do you have any thoughts or ideas of how we can, I mean, it sounds like we could, you know, seek out other information. We can seek out other people who have different perspectives. Like, do you recommend talking to like your friends or family members about this, or what are ways that you envision in an ideal scenario we could combat this as like a community?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I do think about the different levels a lot, the individual micro level and then the broader macro level. And this is something I try to talk about in my book as well, because I think all of that's important. You can't hyper-focus on the individual. You're going to miss a lot of important pieces of information for solving any problem, I think. Mm-hmm. So for this problem, as far as like, how do we consume information more critically and be less biased? I think it's tricky because we don't have those structural pieces that are required to do that a lot of the time. So you mentioned like third spaces. Mm-hmm. That'd be great if there was more third spaces in right. America. So again, the United States, we really, really like to be in our cars and we're hyper individual and mm-hmm. we yep. see the polarization that stems from that. Mm-hmm. So ideally, if I could like wave a magic wand, I would want to have more opportunities for people to join local groups in their communities mm-hmm. and actually meet their neighbors and actually realize that someone who thinks differently than them is not evil and just mm-hmm. maybe has a different interpretation, and they actually can agree on a lot of stuff that they might not even realize. Mm-hmm. And there's, you know, Robert Putnam, I don't know if you're familiar with his work. He had the Bowling Alone book from, I think it was like 2001 when it came out. But he's been studying social isolation and this idea of, if we get more people engage in their local communities, it will help democracy because it will build trust. And you can learn, if you can trust your neighbor, that'll extend to your local community and even like local government and broader government. Mm-hmm. So basically, again, it's kind of like flexing that muscle or practicing that muscle memory of trusting people and realizing I can speak to different people. I often think that whenever we strengthen our communities and become more integrated, it's a way to turn down the temperature of political polarization and polarization more broadly, because not only are we increasing our own social identity complexity, it's going to have like wide-reaching effects. Because if you meet someone who's left or right, and let's say you're left wing, you hang out with someone who's more right wing, and you have a positive interaction, let's say at a bowling league, then that right wing person, the next time they think about a left wing person, might remember you and be like, oh, I actually had a positive encounter with this person, and I should update my beliefs, even if they do this unconsciously. They might not consciously walk it through this, but it's just the psychological process of having that contact with someone who's different than you can increase the warmth that you feel about that particular group. So the trick is then, how do we actually create opportunities for that to occur? And that's something that, I mean, that's like, you need the policy stuff at that point. And that's urban where it gets planning. Really tricky. That's challenging. And, you know, there's some people doing this that are trying to like do nonprofits to get more people meeting together that might not normally meet. But I think more broadly, we can try to seek out those opportunities. They do exist. Like, I really like bringing up sports as an example, because I think it's such a broad group of people. Like, I remember whenever I was playing on my local softball team in Tennessee, I was playing with people with very different politics than me. And I didn't even realize that until the end of the season, when we were just celebrating our season and drinking and just having fun. And then I realized that one of the people on my team was very right wing, and I didn't know that the entire time. And if people had more of those opportunities to seek out people who think differently than them, it would just turn down the temperature of polarization in so many domains.
Well, for our final question, I know we've talked about a lot of heavy topics and things like that. Is there anything that gives you hope right now? Because I feel like I could spiral listening to these conversations of like, oh my God, it's going to only get worse with AI and social media and TikTok and all of these things. And yeah, what's giving you hope right now that we could maybe make some progress, if you have any?
There are things that give me hope. Okay. I know it's tough. I know it's a very tough time now for a variety of reasons. There's a couple things that give me hope. One is the communities that are being formed. So like this podcast, for example, like you guys give me hope, like having these productive conversations and diving into nuance and tackling issues in a thoughtful way. Seeing people do that and seeing more people interested in consuming that type of content, I think is something that is definitely hopeful for me. I'm seeing more people, more science communicators work together. There's a lot of people who are more motivated to rethink how they approach their professions and how they communicate with people. So I hope that in these difficult times, it presents an opportunity to restructure how we've been doing things in a lot of ways, because there are legitimate problems among our institutions, for example. Our institutions were not very good at communicating with the public. I think we saw that with COVID-19, and we continue to see that. They're just kind of stuck in this like 1990s like top down dialogue where we're going to make an announcement and then you just have to trust us. Whereas now I feel in the 2020s and beyond, it, you know, it's very much participatory, where we want to have dialogue with people. And I think finally institutions are starting to understand this more. So as we see some of our institutions lose a lot of trust and resources, unfortunately, I hope that they will be able to rebuild themselves into something better, or different institutions will emerge that can do a better job at presenting credible evidence, but also meeting people where they are and working with communities so it helps everyone.
Thank you so much. Yeah. Where can we learn more about you? Where can people follow you? Tell us all of that.
Yeah, so I am active mostly on Threads and Blue Sky, just my name, Matthew Facciani. I also have a newsletter, Misguided, which is also the name of my book and my podcast. I try to just keep consistent there, where I talk about all of these things that we talk about today. So yeah, if people are interested in my work, my Substack is just Misguided, the newsletter where I talk about my research and research on information science and psychology. And then my book is coming out in July. It's called Misguided. It's all about why we believe misinformation and what we can do about it. And yeah, I'm going to be more active on all these platforms. I'm trying to do more outreach and science communication myself. Instagram, I'm trying to be more active on there as a more visual platform. I'm more text-based a lot of the time, but I'm forcing myself to go outside of my comfort zone and do some visual content as well.
Yeah.
Amazing. Thank you so, so much. This was such an incredible conversation. And yeah, I found you, Matthew, on Threads, and I just think you're like incredible on Threads. And that's how, so I highly recommend people follow you, and we will link to all of this stuff in our show notes.
Yeah, thank you. This is great.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, bye.